everybody. Welcome to Drive Through HR. Brian, William, and Nisha coming to you live every day talking about HR with the HR people who get it done. So, you know, my first question is, William, how are you doing today?
I am doing well, Brian. If I were doing any better, I think there'd be something wrong. I'm fantastic. Thank you for asking.
Yeah, the world would start to spin out of control. We don't need that. Let's be honest. So, well, good. It is a. I think it's going to be a tremendous Tuesday. Never used those two words before together, so it's a first at Drive-Thru HR. Kind of excited about that. So, well, let's get to our guest because it's been a while since he's been on, and he's got some really cool. You know, the things to talk about that I think every company wishes they, the problems that he's trying to solve and his crew over there would love to have. So, Benny Banks, welcome back to Drive Through HR.
Thank you, Brian. I appreciate it. Glad to be here.
Well, if you would introduce yourself to our millions of listeners, and then we'll jump into what's going on in your world.
Millions, don't undersell yourself. It's probably billions if I had to guess. Ben Eubanks, I am the HR manager for a defense contractor here in Huntsville, Alabama, called Pinnacle Solutions. They do really cool stuff like teaching people how to fly helicopters and work with the military, so it's a lot of fun. When I'm not at work, I write a blog, upstarthr.com, and help to run the HR Evolution Fund Conference.
Nice. Well, Ben, let's go right into what's top of mind for you these days or what's keeping you up at night.
All right. So what's keeping me up at night, we've been looking at some growth for a while, but yesterday we actually had a sit-down meeting to look at the physical requirements of it, and it kind of hit home really for me. We currently have about 25 staff at our local Huntsville office. The company has 70 people overall, so not really that big. But we're looking at adding about 15 to our local office in 30 days. And that just really, adding 15 more to the 25, that's more than 50% growth right there in that area. And honestly, that scared me a little bit, partially because we're not actually recruiting for any positions. All these people are currently working on their contracts. And, you know, 30 days from now, that switch is going to be flipped, whatever, and they're also going to become Pinnacle employees on that first day, and I'm trying to deal with that in the context of we have a very rigorous hiring process and how we bring people on and how we onboard them, and I know right now that some of those people are not going to be a fit for the kind of culture, the kind of way we do things, just the things that we believe in that are the most important. Based on the history of the contract, I already know that some of them are not going to be a fit. And so I'm trying to deal with that in advance of actually getting these employees on board.
Yeah. Well, take us through your normal onboarding process, if you don't mind. Kind of give us some insight into how do you normally onboard someone?
So at my last company, it was funny because for them onboarding that orientation, I hand you a book, tell you about your benefits, and then I send you off into the world with, good luck, basically. And here at Pinnacle, we do things a little bit differently. As far back as the interview process, we're already kind of testing people based on our value system and our culture and trying to understand how they fit into that so that by day one, they already understand the basics of the things that are important to us, even if they don't understand the work processes, workflow, things like that, the management structure. They might not have all that down, but they know before they walk in on day one, you know, our number one core value is deliver on time every time. These things that are so important to us that matter for every employee, you know, each employee is even rated on those things, so they're kind of key. But, you know, the first day someone comes in, they sit down with me, they do all the traditional kind of in-processing stuff, here's the big data dump for you, and then I actually have them sit down with our president for half an hour, and he takes them through the history of the company, some of our current things are working on, and get their ideas as a brand new person with no predisposition to any sort of commentary, and just says, hey, what do you think about these things we're doing? What about this area? What about, and just ask them some things to get their feedback as a brand new set of eyes. And then I kind of have a series of touch points with them, first day, first week, first month, just come back and saying, hey, how's everything going? Are you getting everything you need from your manager? And also on the managerial side, doing that as well, come back to them, are you getting everything you need from the employee, making sure that they're meshing as well as possible? Because the goal, honestly, it sounds kind of, you know, cold or whatever, but the goal is to have that person up to 100% productivity as soon as possible. If I can get that done in a month, that money saved on our part. You know, if it takes them 3 months to get them there, then we're you know, paying someone and not getting that full effort out of them. It might not be their fault because we're not giving them all the information, all the tools, everything they need. So my goal is to work with the managers and ensure that that person is up to 100% productivity as soon as reasonably possible.
And with contractors, you know, if it's like anything that I've done in the past, you don't really go through any of the cultural or the, you know, kind of figuring out, you know, making sure that, you know, morale and, you know, ethics alignment, you know, all of that other stuff. You don't really do that with contractors because really you just need their output. So, which, you know, sounds a little harsh, but, you know, that's just kind of the world we live in. How do you think you're going to interact with these contractors that's going to flip to employees? Are you going to start doing some of the cultural integration and culture work now?
The way we've done it in the past, a couple of years ago, we had a really good experiment. It was a live experiment. We went from 25 employees up to about 60 overnight. We won a contract on a Friday, and that following Monday, those 40 people became Pinnacle employees. And so we had that then. That was a month before I started, so I got to play on the back end of it, but not on the front end and the prep and everything else, which 2 days isn't really much to prep for it. But so I didn't get much experience with that. But after the award of the contract and people became employees, we started pouring ourselves into treating them as well as we possibly could. And that was, you know, within a day or two of starting, that was the key thing that I was learning from my manager, who was the HR person at that time, was if someone has something that they need help with, your goal is to get them some sort of answer, some sort of response within 24 hours, even if it's, I'm checking on that, I'm trying to find out. But that was a very, very high standard that she set, just because in the past, they would pick up the phone and call their HR person, and they wouldn't answer, or they would not help them, or they just, I don't know, they just weren't getting anything. And I've heard from dozens of people up there, you know, that, hey, you know, I've got a question, I've got a problem, I thought I could call you because, you know, you've been very helpful with this other little thing that to me meant nothing, but to them was just a small act of kindness that meant that I actually cared and that there was a person on the other side of that phone, not just the HR police ready to say no to everything. So it's, as far as culture indoctrination, we within 30 days, someone gets their performance, sit down with their manager, set their performance goals for the year, and those performance goals are tied into the actual culture, the core values of the company. So everyone from our CEO all the way down to, you know, the admin at the front desk has some sort of value embedded into their actual performance. So it's not like it's just a plaque hanging in the lobby that you point at and say, hey, that's what we do, and then you never see it again. We remind them of it. We have mid-year reviews. We have these constant reminders that this stuff is important to us. This stuff is not just a platitude or a nice to have. This is a key thing that's successful so far and will continue to into the future.
What's the most intimidating aspect of growth from a human resources perspective? You know, what's terrifying about growth?
Right now, I feel like I am at the limit of what I can do as far as just bandwidth. You know, I'm working, you know, for the last couple of weeks, 50 hours a week, trying to get these things done. We have 12 positions we're recruiting for outside of this effort. So that's not even including those. So just having the bandwidth for all these things, because I'm, you know, I'm recruiting for helicopter pilots to go to Saudi Arabia. That's not exactly as easy as finding an accountant to come in and, you know, to do accounts receivable or something like that. So it's just this big, complex mass of things, and I'm looking at the plan for adding someone sometime this year once we get these extra people on board and it becomes more than I can, you know, feasibly handle. I'm going to put together a business case and go to the CEO with a plan to hire someone else for the HR team.
What do you let's dig into that if you don't mind. What do you want them to do? What's the things that you need to focus on as opposed to someone else helping out with?
So I am terrible at the details and the organization and things like that. I love to make things happen, to put plans in place and to do things like that. But as far as once something is done, once an action is complete, going back and making sure that's filed and that the records are actually kept perfectly and everything, that stuff is done now, but it's so draining for me, it's so difficult for me that I just like wait till it stacks up in a big pile and then I go do that. So I'm going to look for someone that has those strengths that I don't have and try to complement what I already have to offer. I'm also going to look for someone who has a – so when I was interviewing, I remember this, you know, very well. I was sitting there and – the lady who would be my manager said, if you see a piece of paper in the floor, what do you do? I said, throw it in the trash, you know, some sort of trick question or something. And she laughed, but she said, you know, we have had people that think that's someone else's job. That's not my job. And in a company our size, if there's something going on and it's not assigned to someone, you might as well take it on yourself and get it fixed because it's got to be done for things to be run as well as they are. One time we had someone, you know, there was some trash on the floor or something, and they walked by it for a week before someone said, hey, are you going to, like, pick that up or what? She's like, oh, well, I didn't think it was my job. Yeah, it's everybody's job. You know, everybody needs to be pitching in, doing every little thing. So they can't have the it's not my job mentality. So those are just a couple of things that I'm looking for. I'm going to hire someone at the low level and train them on how we do things at Pinnacle and how things are different because, like I said, these things we focus on, even the HR function is different from a lot of companies. Like I talked about the last place I worked, it was very reactive. It was okay, there's a problem, now let's go do something about it. And I kept coming back to our manager who was leading the HR function at the last company saying, if we would just do some of these things on the front end, we could reduce those requests for help. There's reduce our fires and other problems, and they were always, no, we don't have time for that. Let's just keep fighting fires and keep, you know, try to keep our heads above water. And they're going to win always just reacting to problems.
Nice. You know, it's the 80-20 rule that, you know, a lot of people are they're reactive 80% of the time, proactive 20% of the time, and what it should be is the opposite. You should be reactive only 20% of the time and proactive 80% of the time. And I think it's knowing when to do what and working that teeter-totter is probably the hardest thing that we all kind of face. I want to ask a question about recruiting in Northern Alabama. You know that I spent 3 years of my life in Birmingham and absolutely love the state of Alabama. I never really got up north all that often other than to Mentone a couple times. I want you to take the audience into what it's like, you know, to recruit both at your company, but just in Northern Alabama.
So, let's see. I've only recruited, you know, I've only lived here, and I've only recruited here, so I don't know how it might be different from other places. Like I talked about, a lot of the companies in Huntsville is actually the second most concentrated group of government contractors outside of D.C., basically. So the majority of the people that work for us and for other companies locally, you know, have security clearances and things like that. That makes it a more difficult hiring process. One of our contracts requires us to hire someone with a clearance currently. That shrinks the pool down dramatically for people that we can hire for. And then, you know, I'm not sure if you're familiar with like a security clearance, but someone, even something that nowadays is relatively common, like having credit problems or a bankruptcy or something like that because you can't, you know, a foreclosure, those things could disqualify someone from getting a security clearance, even if they're the best, you know, software engineer on aviation systems that ever existed. If they can't get that clearance, they might not be able to work on any of the programs that we have available. So that makes it kind of tough to recruit for. And beyond that, I'm not sure. You know, we don't do the majority of our recruiting, thankfully, is done through referrals, especially when we're hiring specialty positions like helicopter pilots, things like that. I mentioned a minute ago we're looking for – I have a position open now for a Black Hawk test pilot in Australia. I keep asking if I can go and do a site survey and check it out beforehand, but they keep saying no. But I would – that just those positions are difficult, you know, obviously, to try to fill those things. So I reach out to some of our guys who are already pilots in the Black Hawk community and start this long chain of requests, basically, until we find someone that, you know, be a referral, and then bring them in and talk to them. And it's interesting because, our pilot interviews are very different from our, you know, like I said, our admin, our accounting interviews. We do a very different interview process for our pilots. Basically, it's do you do the job? Do you meet the qualifications? Do we feel comfortable trusting you to go 2,000 miles away and represent us? If we can answer those three questions, then, you know, we'll put you in front of our customer and see if they like you, you know, as opposed to, you know, two or three rounds of interviews for some other position in our local office that would require a little more stringent process.
Sure. Nice, Ben. This is Brian, and you're listening to Director HR. We'll do a quick reset, and we're on with Ben Eubanks. And so, Ben, I mean, what do you do, what are the internal conversations with, because the recruiting is so specific, right? I mean, Black Hawk pilot in Australia, that is a really specific position, obviously. So how do you work around it not bottlenecking or totally choking the company from a business perspective? What are the internal conversations?
When I hear about these things, usually I am very lucky in that my predecessor helped to set HR for success. I sit in on like our business development meetings, our marketing things, when we're looking at new efforts, things like that, and I get a say in what efforts to go after, because sometimes they'll say, hey, we have this thing where we can go for this contract for computer engineers up in Iowa, but then I'll come in and say, okay, this is the unionized workforce, or these are the things you guys probably haven't thought about. Well, we have to start doing these new regulations and things will affect us if we go after that. So sometimes it's, you know, having to be the no person saying, this would be too much of an effort for us to try to do remotely. But other times, things like this, I'll hear about it and then get to start doing the legwork in the front end for you know, what sort of labor laws apply in Australia, and trying to do the advanced work on those things and getting workers' comp coverage for another country and things like that. But the biggest fear that I have when I start looking at one of these is I can do all this advanced work, I can do all this prep, I can try to reach out to as many as I think I can find that might be able to connect me with someone. But the bottom line is, for some of the jobs we recruit for, there might be, you know, 20 people in the world that do that. So it's that when I'm in the throes of the recruiting process and calling people all day and emailing, setting up interviews and things for this type of job, it scares me to death to think that HR or the recruiting/HR function could be the reason that we fail to get something. And that's a lot of pressure. And you know, in the past, I've always been able to come through and find the person, but sometimes it's just that fear's still there, I guess.
Yeah. Hey, a quick question from the Twitter sphere around your PHR prep materials and your blog. you obviously put together a ton of materials for folks, so those that are studying for the PHR. The question is, when are you planning to take the SPHR?
I'm planning to take the SPHR as soon as I have the required years of experience. I think it's 4 with a BA, 4 or 5, I can't remember off the top of my head, with a BS, I mean. But once I get to that level, the first couple of years that I had in the HR field were non-exempt, so those don't count as real HR according to HRCI. But for the last couple of years, I've been working at Pinnacle, built my experience up, and once I get to that level, I plan on taking the SPHR, and I don't know that I'm looking forward to it, but it will be an interesting experience, that's for sure.
You won't lack from testing materials, right?
Oh, that's for sure.
And see, it seems like you're a little bit... Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I talk to a lot of people. You know, I've been teaching people how to pass the PHR exam for 3 years now, and I tell a lot of people that study skills, having a good study plan, having a strategy in place, that is half the battle. Yeah, you got to learn all this content and things, but if you can understand, you know, how they're asking the questions and a lot of just the background information behind the psychology of studying for the exam, and they'll spend their day studying for his PMP certification, I believe, and I would say, well, here's how I teach people to study for the PHR. That's basically what I need to know. Yeah, but, you know, I teach people how to do this, and, you know, the questions are a little different for HR people, but if you understand the pieces of how to study and prepare, then that can get you a long way, and that's what I try to help people with, because there's other things out there, the Sherman Learning System, HRCP, all those things, they have, you know, a lot of marketing money, a lot of development money to get these really complex, detailed study guides and tools out there. I cannot compete with that, but I can help teach people how to understand the exams, how to understand how to study and things like that, and that's what I focus on, and the motivational side of it too. You know, how to stay motivated for 10, 12 weeks of studying, because you've been there, William. You know it's not exactly a fun process sitting there studying on a Saturday night when you want to be doing anything else.
Yeah. It's funny, before I took the GMAT, I took a Princeton Review class in Tucson, and the teacher was a professional test taker. He went to Yale undergrad, and he was getting his master's in, like, you know, philosophy or English or something like that. And but he was a professional test taker on the side, just kind of was something he did. He could take any standardized test and score in the 98th percentile. Like on a random Saturday, he'd just go and, you know, sign up for the MCAT or the LSAT, and then just sit in, take it, and get a 98th percentile.
Wow.
Yeah. Wicked. But again, wicked smart, great recall. But he knew, to your point, he knew the formula of how questions are asked. So he could rule out, not knowing the content, he could rule out, you know, 3 of the 4 of the answers, or at least half of the answers, et cetera. So amazing guy. You've been really active on your blog in the last couple of months, which, A, I appreciate, because I like your content, but I wanted to kind of know a little bit more of, like, the resurgence and kind of putting content out there, where you think you're going to take your personal, you know, Upstart HR, where you're going to take that in 2013.
So I've been trying to hang with the 3 times a week posting schedule, and, you know, I sit down on Saturday mornings, and I keep expecting there to be a day when I sit down and I can't think of something to write. But throughout the week, I'm putting down ideas and things, and I have 400 or something drafts sitting out there. I just don't have the time to write them yet, and I love the whole process of writing and sharing with people. And that's one of the things I was thinking about when we were talking, this random issue that I brought up to discuss today. I'm just writing about the things that I'm facing, and I think the blog does well because it's things that, you know, real HR people are facing every day. And as far as where the blog's going to go, I have a couple ideas for some new products and things to put out there. I'm working on some partnerships with some great companies. Tribe HR is one of them. They're a great company up in Canada, and I'm working on stuff with them for Sherm, actually. And just I want to do some more video content. I really enjoy that. It's just finding the quiet time when nobody else is around the house to shout through the door while I'm doing one. So, I mean, I don't know what the long-term plan is. I don't know what I'm going to do in, you know, a year from now, but I know this week, next week, I've already got stuff laid out, and I'm just looking forward to the next time I get to sit down and actually do some writing for the blog.
Nice. Well, Ben, that's just keep doing what you're doing. It's I think there's a lot of people that have absolutely appreciated the content you're putting out there, and you do it in a way that I think people can actually go, you know, action off of pretty quickly. You don't have to dig in and devote yourself to figure it out. You lay it out very simplistically, and I think it does a lot of good for the community for sure. So, what's the conference schedule look like for the rest of the year? Because you've got a lot of things going on. Just kind of tell us where you're going to be at, so if people want to actually meet you in person, they'll get some shots.
Over the next couple weeks, I actually have some local stuff I'm doing, which probably doesn't reach out to much of the audience. I'm speaking for some local Sherm chapters and things like that, and to a group of college students here. I'll definitely be at Sherm, and I'm really looking forward to that. In Chicago, it's going to be a lot of fun. It always is, and I'm always just blown away. You know, sitting down with some of the smartest people in the HR space and all these thought leaders, and they just let me hang around with them, so that's fun. And then the other big thing that I have on the calendar is obviously HR Evolution. It'll be in October, the Sunday before the HR Technology Conference. I don't have that date right in front of me, but we are going back to Las Vegas, and it's going to be amazing. We're lining up the speakers now, and we're about to get the tickets up for sale. So thehrevolution.org. It's the website for that, and we're really looking forward to having another amazing event.
Well, that is exciting. Any spoilers you want to throw out there that we need to know about, we're not supposed to know about around HR Evolution?
Honestly, I can't think of anything right now. That's actually a terrible marketing opportunity that I missed, but we're pretty transparent with the event. You know, we're pretty out there and open between me, Steve, Trish, and Matt. So if there's anything to be said, we usually get it out there for our people because it's a very participatory event as opposed to being some shrouded in secrecy type thing that communicates some other things.
Well, no worries, my friend. Well, it was awesome to have you back on, and I know next time, like you said, it's a pretty transparent event. So I was just digging. I was cutting edge journalism there, trying to figure something out that nobody else knew around HR Evolution. But we'll get there next time. I have faith in that. So, well, good luck with Hypergrowth, man. God, everything is going well, and of course, always like seeing the pictures of the babies who aren't babies anymore. They're kids that are growing, so that's always a blast to share that. And everybody out there, all you need to put in is Ben Eubanks, and he is everywhere. So connect with him, folks. We are absolutely out of here.